It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hey, I'm Adam Carolla.
Hi, my name is Penn Jillette.
Not only listening, I'm the guest.
I'm a Penn and Teller, and I am the fourth listener.
And I am the fourth listener.
And that must make me at least the fourth listener.
To keep our three listeners coming back, we must be doing something right. And if you're the fourth listener, we thank you for the support. You can get every episode with no ads at patreon.com/David C. Smalley and take advantage of your fourth listener status.
And we're going to sue David Smalley for slander.
With a world divided, it's time to resurrect nuance and remember the importance of conversation. He's an actor, he's a comedian, and he'll make you think. This is David C. Smalley.
Yes, it is. It's been a little bit of time since I put a show out. My deep and sincere apologies to all the people who thought I fell off of the flat earth. I've got so many episodes coming. Some are already recorded. We're going to be pushing them out really quick. I'm doing a text response show for everybody who sent their feedback in to 424-306-0798. 424-306-0798. I finally got all that organized. And some of you have already responded to and said I'm going to be doing that soon. This is not that show, but I'm about to release that show right after this. So we're going to be backloading September with a bunch of content. I promise it's coming. And what happened was, what had happened was, I had three guests for the first 3 weeks of September. This has never happened to me in 12 years of doing this show. I get to the first guest and they say, hey, I'm not able to do the show. I've got to cancel. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was going to do a text response show, and then I got pulled into some other entertainment stuff here in LA, and I was not able to do a show that first week. And I thought, that's okay. Next week I have my other guests, so I'll just do my show next week. It'll be like 7 days late on an episode. My folks will understand. My people are awesome. And then get ready to record the second week, and the person's like, hey, I've had something come up. I can't record today. Let's reschedule. And I was like, oh no, not two in a row. And then again, I got pulled aside and did not have the response show ready. So I couldn't release that yet. And I thought, well, you know what? 3 weeks is a long time to go without a show, but my people will understand. They're cool. I've got a show coming up this week. It's going to be great. It's going to be a really cool show. And I thought the universe was playing a joke on me. The person was like, hey, so sorry, I've had something come up. I can't record. And I'm like, no. Three people in a row all had to cancel. So I don't blame them. You know, stuff happens. It just so happened to be all three of them in the same month. So I end up going a large part of September without shows. So thank you so much for sticking by and for staying here, especially if you're on Patreon. We're going to be doing some cool stuff. So I'm going to make sure it's worth it. And sometimes, you know, I just load you up with two or three shows in a week. So hopefully you had stuff to go back and listen to. This episode is, you know how whenever I come on a show, on someone else's show, I always record it, and then I offer that to my listeners as an episode. That's what today is. I was interviewed. It was a great interview by Janice Selby, and she's the host of Divorcing Religion podcast. And She asked me if I'd be a guest, and I said yes, but that's also another time I'm supposed to record. How about we record them both at the same time? And she thought it was a great idea. So now you get to hear an episode of the Divorcing Religion podcast where I'm the guest as an episode of the David C. Smalley podcast. It's Podception is what we're doing here today. So I do want to remind you that I have Dirty Church this Sunday. I'd love for you to come out to Dirty Church at the Hollywood Improv. It's a stand-up comedy show where we are bringing some dirty material. I'll be honest with you, folks. It's gets a little religious, it gets a little self-righteous, it gets a little insulty, and gets pretty damn dirty. So I would love for you to come get dirty with me at the Hollywood Improv. Tickets are at davidcsmalley.com. Tickets are at hollywoodimprov.com. We're going to have a blast doing it. So it is 6:30 p.m. Sunday, October 2nd. I hope to see you there. This episode of the show, like I said, is with Janice Selby. Now, Janice, for those of you who don't know, Janice was the one when Devin came on and we said we're going to raise money and help Devin out. We did that through Janice. She was very gracious with her time and energy, and she was wonderful with Devin. So she's actually a registered professional counselor. She's a religious recovery consultant, and she works one-on-one with clients recovering from religious trauma syndrome. She's the founder of the Conference on Religious Trauma at religioustraumaconference.org, and she's the host of the Divorcing Religion podcast, which you're about to hear right now. It's also available on YouTube, as well as the Divorcing Religion workshop at divorcing-religion.com. She's super excited about her latest conference, and I'm excited about this too. It's called Shameless Sexuality: Life After Purity Culture. It's taking place online October 14th through the 16th. This event is for anyone interested in recovering from toxic purity culture indoctrination. You can get tickets and information right now at shamelesssexuality.org. shamelesssexuality.org, online conference. You don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. In addition to student discounts and partial scholarships, continuing education credits are also available for this event. So reach out to Janice at shamelesssexuality.org. Sign up October 14th to the 16th. Enjoy the Shameless Sexuality Conference. Life After Purity Culture, man, that is such a great idea. So many of us need that. I remember I've had several, you know, sex therapists and former Christians on who talk about how even though people have lost their religion or left their faith or whatever, they drag baggage with them into their new secular lives. And they just sort of, I guess, keep things with them that they don't realize have religious roots. And sometimes you have to go through something like this, like a Shameless Sexuality Conference, to go, oh my God, I didn't even realize I no longer believe in the faith, but I was still making comments about sexuality or shaming someone or having certain thoughts about sex in certain ways that came from my religious ideology. And so if I've given up on that ideology, maybe I need to rethink some things that built that framework around sexuality. So I'm so glad she's doing this. Janice is an absolutely wonderful person. Here is the episode of the Divorcing Religion podcast that I just had the honor of being a guest on. Please enjoy.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. I am tickled to have David C. Smalley as my guest today. And he is a very exciting guest, so I had to write out some things, so I didn't want to forget them. In addition to being a successful comedian and actor with over 100 million views on TikTok, David C. Smalley has also hosted his own podcast for over 12 years, making over 600 episodes downloaded some 60 million times. Can you believe it? The David C. Smalley podcast includes discussions that are inspiring and funny, with cordial debates on skepticism, religion, spirituality, politics, and more. I was privileged to join David on one of his episodes to discuss religious trauma and recovery, and now I'm delighted that he's joining me here as a guest on the Divorcing Religion podcast. Welcome, David Smalley.
Thank you so much for having me. Lovely intro. I appreciate it.
It's so nice to see you. I know you're terribly busy living that Hollywood LA kind of life. And so for you to make time to join me on my fledgling show is really appreciated.
Well, I love what you do, and I want to be you when I grow up. when I was in college, when I didn't start college, I was in my mid-20s, because I thought you had to be rich to go to college. That's just what I was always taught. I didn't know student loans were a thing. I know that sounds silly, but I just didn't know. And I kept thinking, when I started figuring out this whole religion thing, and I was also in school for psychology, I thought, I want to be a therapist that helps people overcome the traumas of religion. And I looked everywhere and it didn't exist. There was no such thing. And this was probably 2005, 2006. And so I was really discouraged and even really starting that path because of that. So several years later, I remember bumping into a few therapists who were in that field a little, but it was a, it wasn't so specific. It was more like PTSD stuff that was connected to religious abuse. And it wasn't, you know, so much recovering from actual religious trauma. And then when recovering from religion started, I thought, wait a minute, this is becoming a thing finally. But by then I was already in the, my whole podcast, entertainment, stand-up comedy thing. And so when I heard your title and I heard what you did several years ago when we first met, I just went, on one hand, I was a little envious that you had found that. And I was like, oh man, I could have kept going and found that. And on the other hand, I was so happy that someone was out there doing it, because I think you're doing it so much better than I ever could. I feel like I found my lane and I enjoy it. And I'm so happy you're doing what you do. So it's an honor to be on your program with you. Seriously, I love what you do. I love it.
That's so delightful. Thank you. And I got to say, it was a hard road, well-earned to get here, because I come from a very fundamentalist background and I had to free myself by divorcing religion. And I also divorced my husband, and that kind of started me on the trajectory to where I am today. I think people would be interested to know a little bit about your background and how religion impacted you.
So I don't know how far you want to go back. I mean, my first religious memory is one that my mother denies and swears I made it up, but I don't know how I could have. My first religious memory was, I was about 5 years old, and no, I'll take it back. This is my second. So my first religious memory was, I was between four or five, and I don't know why. I think there were big kids outside riding bikes around Halloween and they had masks on. Seemed very demonic and devilish, and it scared me. And I had some sort of 4-year-old panic attack. And my mom was going to be leaving. She was going out. And I just kept telling my mom, I don't want to be here. I'm scared. I don't want to be home without you here. And so my mom asked my sister to read the Bible to me to calm me down. And I don't know where she started or why, but it worked. For some reason, whatever part she picked, I felt so much better.
Oh, nice.
And so it started off being a very positive thing for me. And then shortly thereafter, right around the age of five, I remember being in my room and I was thinking about all the bad things that happen in the world, because that's what a neurotic 5-year-old does. And I was wondering how I could save everyone. I wanted to know how I could fix the problems of the world. And I thought, well, no matter if they're a bank robber or a killer or some kind of bad guy, everything is connected to Satan and the demons. So if I can just fix the demons, then that will make all the problems go away. Like, I was really working this out like a good project manager. And I thought, the old demons are probably too far gone and very powerful and scary, and I don't want them. But surely they have babies, and those are going to be the demons of the future. So why don't we just adopt baby demons and raise them to be good?
Oh, my God.
That was my 5-year-old plan to save the world. And then I started thinking, my mom's never going to go for me having baby demons in the house. So how could I get my mom to let me take in some baby demons? And so I thought I nailed it, but I walked in the living room and I was like, "Mom, do you think maybe baby demons are cute?" I had pictured in my head, you know, tiny little toddler demons with big heads and eyes and wobbling around. Of course, they got the little pointy tails, but they're adorable, you know?
Sure.
And I thought my mom was going to go for it and be like, "Yeah, they're probably pretty cute." And then I was going to be like, "Well, why don't we get a couple and see how it goes?" Mm-hmm. And then we were going to save the world, because then there would be no one wanting to bring evil about the earth. And instead, because I said baby demon and cute, I was snatched up, taken to the bathroom, and a bar of Dial soap was shoved into my mouth.
Oh, no.
And so there was water running, and she was scrubbing my teeth and tongue with a bar of soap.
Oh, dear.
To wash my mouth out, because I had said that a demon might be cute. And all that did was make me never want to tell her anything. It certainly didn't make me not want to help the demons. I thought maybe one already got to her. Like, this is awful the way she's treating me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really talk to her about much after that. You know, I think when it came to religion, I was probably 11 or 12 before I brought anything else up again. And it had to do with, I think I asked her if God could see through covers.
I wonder why.
I'll let you just worry about that one later. I was just curious. Can he see through my Ninja Turtle blanket? You know? And then after that, of course, she was like, "Huh?" And that didn't go well either. So I don't think we ever talked about it again until I was, you know, about 25. And I went, "I don't believe this stuff, Mom. I've been reading about it, and I think I'm an atheist." And that's not what she wanted. But yeah, I've got a whole story, I guess, that I wrote about in my book called Baptized Atheist. And it's essentially me being baptized is the moment that made me really think about this stuff. It felt official. It felt real. And then
how old were you?
15.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I start the book off by saying, the pastor asked, I'm standing in the warm holy water in the baptistry. And he said, "Do you believe Jesus Christ died for your sins so that you may enter the kingdom of heaven?" And I said, "Yes." And then he put me under the water, and it felt like I was under there forever, because I was just like, it felt so official, and it was in front of an audience, and I'd never been asked that question directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately doubted everything. I was like, "Well, that doesn't make sense." Like, I'm under the water being baptized, and I'm just thinking, how does punishing the innocent pardon the guilty? Mm-hmm. Why would a God set this up? And why am I just now thinking about this right now? I'm in a robe in front of
Epiphany
people.
Epiphany in the baptismal
thing. Yeah. And then I came up, and I was just mortified. And so now I'm like, I've got this stench on me of holy water. And it wasn't that it was bad. It's that I felt bad. Right. I felt like I had poisoned the water, that I had poisoned the church by being there. I felt evil for not immediately believing everything. Did I just lie in a church filled with holy water? Is anybody else going to be okay getting in that water? I was terrified that I had just done something awful. And then I was immediately told I have to go win souls. So we got to go door knocking. So I'm standing there, still fresh out of the baptistry, waiting for the other kids to be baptized. And the pastor, and I write this in the book, must have seen the doubt on my face, because he never looked at me. He just leaned down to me and he goes, "You know, son, you can't just say you believe. You got to know it to be true in your heart." And when he said that, everything changed for me, because I was like, I didn't tell him that. But I was like, I don't believe any of this stuff.
Wow.
And I didn't go, "Now I'm an atheist." I went, "I've got to figure this stuff out before someone finds out I'm having doubts." Mm-hmm. So I dove into the book, and I was reading the Bible, and I was winning souls, door knocking. And the more I read the Bible, the less it made sense. And and then I would research why this was 1995, 1996. So I was grabbing encyclopedias. I was going to libraries. I was spending my time figuring out, like, where did this book come from? Who really wrote Mark? Is Mark a real person? What language was it in? Are there books of the Bible that are missing? Why does my mom's Bible have the Apocrypha and my dad's Bible doesn't? Like, what is going on? And they're all both called the Bible. And I was making notes and making notes, making notes. And I did this for 14 years.
Wow.
And eventually said, that basically I was trying to get close to God, and I got so close I saw that there was no need for one.
So. Wow. That is quite a story. So we know your mom was religious because she asked Big Sister to read you a Bible story when you were in distress. Was church going a regular part of your life?
I have never known my mom to be in a church. When I got baptized, I was going to church on my own. It actually happened because of a school event. That's how they got me. They, it was called Fifth Quarter, and they came to a football game, stayed all four quarters, and then gathered kids up who were vulnerable or latchkey kids or kids who had no dads at home or whatever, or single parent homes, and gathered us all up and said, hey, to get you off the street so that you're not partying after the game, why don't you come to church? Right. And that's how they got me. And I went with a group of friends, and I ended up doing the altar call and walking down and crying, yes, I've touched my pee-pee. You know, it's that whole guilt thing where you feel like they're talking to you. Have you masturbated? Have you had thoughts about women? And I'm like, every 11 minutes, I'm 15. And so I just confessed that I had, you know, had impure thoughts and gave my life to Christ. And then I was also a drummer. I was a musician, and so they immediately asked me to start playing in the church choirs and things like that. So, and then I was able to make money. Like, I was being paid to be part of the band at church, and as that 14 years that I was going through, I was part of the worship ministry, and so yeah, it was a pretty big part of my life. I was going to church. I think my mom came one time. She watched me get baptized. And I don't recall her ever going back, ever. She's not a church person. She doesn't like it.
And yet she sure had a hard time with your deconversion.
Well, yeah, because for her, church is, I mean, God is, it's her personal relationship. She would always say, I talk to God like he's sitting on the edge of my bed, like he's my best friend, not like he's an authoritarian or a father figure that I have to go to his house and worship. She always would say church is whenever two or more people are talking about God. So she would consider this church, literally. Mm-hmm. So she thinks if she's sitting, you know, if she's in prayer, she's in church. So she's against the organization of it. She's against the, you know, write down your name and address. I think she was a member of a church one time, and she missed a Sunday, and they came and knocked on her door. And wondering why she wasn't at church. And she was like, you need to get the hell off my porch. Because she's still a badass redneck too. You know what I mean? She'll still be like, how about I kick your ass? And, you know, so she's a tough lady, but she's religious. So she's got that. I've got a personal relationship with God, but I'm not going to go play the game and be a part of the church and give donations, you know?
So has your relationship with her changed as a result of you moving away from the faith, and particularly them being in the line of work that you do, which can be, you know, somewhat X-rated. So how does mom cope with that? How does that affect your relationship?
So as far as my comedy being the X or R-rated, like, hardcore comedy, she thinks it's hilarious. She comes to the comedy shows when I'm when I'm touring and I'm in the Dallas area, she'll come. As a matter of fact, at the end of my last show that we filmed, I did like a half hour. I had everybody in the club raise a drink to my mom, for it was her birthday. And I had them, it was her 70th birthday, and we did a toast to her, and she had just beat breast cancer as well. So she came with a bunch of people. It was sold out. It was a huge show. We had a blast. So, cool. So she has a good time at my shows.
Right on.
And she'll even text me sometimes and reference some of the jokes I said that night. And so she had a good time. Me moving away from religion definitely strained our relationship, the first several years. I was uninvited to Easter, because I was pointing out the hypocrisy of the whole thing. You know, I was explaining the history of where it came from and the rabbit and the egg and the, you know, Esther and all the history that we all know. And I was talking about, you know, the fertility goddess and all this. I was like, that's where we got it from. And it was co-opted by Christians as a as an adaptive technique to take over. It was never really thought, you know, that Jesus actually did that or whatever. And I did the same with Christmas. You know, I was like, Jesus, if he existed and if he was born, was not born when it was winter. You know,
right.
Definitely was probably around March or April, as far as the scholars say. And so they didn't like any of that. And all I was doing is listing like what most scholars agree to. And my mom was very upset. I passed out I passed out winter solstice cards one year at Christmas. I was banned for a couple of years for passing out a winter solstice card. I wasn't saying don't be Christian. I was just saying here's some history behind it, and that was a no-no. So, but then, you know, my whole family, like, they give gifts and they have dinner and they drink a bunch of vodka and smoke cigarettes and, you know, have edibles or smoke weed. I mean, it's a it's any other party. And so I never understood, you know, and then when I was like, Mom, it's not really, you don't really celebrate it like it's anything religious. And she would take a firm stand and be like, when we're celebrating in my home, it's for Jesus. I'm like, really? You're smoking a pack of Winston's for Jesus?
For Jesus.
Yeah, I'm like, are you going to make you an alcoholic drink for Jesus? It doesn't make any sense. There's so many people in the South do that. There's such, it's hypocritical, you know, to say, no, this is a religious experience. And if you're a non-believer, you're not welcome.
Right.
But then all you do is eat fried chicken and drink alcohol. You're not. That's not a religious celebration. You know, your body is a temple. You're definitely not doing what God or Jesus had commanded in the Bible, but whatever. I think more so it was, I was a reminder that there were inconsistencies. And if I wasn't there, then they were never confronted with the nonsense that they were supposedly celebrating, or they weren't confronted with the contradiction that they were having by smoking and drinking on the Lord's Day, right?
Yeah.
So
now
things are better, or they got better for a long time. My mom even agreed to come on my podcast once, but she wouldn't talk about religion. It was only politics, and that has been more of a divisive thing than religion ever was.
Wow.
Her stuff with Trump and DeSantis and immigration and misinformation and TikTok and OAN and Fox News, and that stuff has driven my mother and I apart. Because, and I'll stop blabbering and let you ask questions, I promise, but I just want to say it's, and I think a lot of people will relate to this. It's so bizarre. I don't really call it ironic. It's more bizarre that the very people who taught us right from wrong, taught us to be good for goodness sake, not to appear good, to be honest, to have integrity, to treat people with respect, to love your neighbor as yourself.
Compassion.
These people, some of these people who raised us to believe these things are supporting one of the most immoral, disgusting, grotesque human beings that have ever walked the face of the earth, and defending it and defending lies and defending misinformation and not caring that millions were dying during COVID while it was being ignored, or, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are suffering and need asylum from their countries and need help and are running from drug cartels. And you just want to build a wall so that they're trapped in this location. Like, I keep pushing back and saying, what would Jesus do? Like, I find myself as an atheist talking with these believers going, what do you think Jesus would say? Do you think Jesus would say, build the damn wall? Do you think Jesus would say, lock her up? Like, come on.
She respond?
She'll actually try to find Bible verses where Jesus talked about following the law. And I'm like, well, you do realize the only thing that makes it a law is the fact that it's illegal to cross. They're not bad people. They're running. And by the way, side note, the vast majority of people, especially that are being shipped to Martha's Vineyard and all this other nonsense, are here legally seeking asylum, filling out paperwork, and waiting to be processed. And then they're being shipped out of state, which is very questionable as far as what laws are being broken by doing that. So they're not illegals. A human being cannot just be illegal. Right. Where's the compassion? Where is the care for people that are needing help?
Exactly.
And I think, I know my mom, I know she does love people, and I know she would give her last dollar to feed somebody. I would love to just take my mom to the border and talk to a person. Be like, why did you want to come here? What's going on in your life? My mom would be in tears and say, come live with me. In a
right.
heartbeat.
Yes.
But she's so she's disconnected from the human aspect of it because Tucker Carlson and OAN and these TikToks are going, what are they really here to do? Are they here to steal and rape and kill? Maybe you should be careful. Maybe you should lock your doors. And now she gets afraid and they're fear-mongers. So she gets wrapped up in misinformation. And I told her the other day, I was like, Mom, you always told me, believe none of what you hear and half of what you see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, but you're believing everything on TikTok.
Yes. Yes.
Like, so just that skepticism you taught me, remember it and put it into practice. That compassion and love that you taught me, remember it and put it to practice. I want, I told her the other day, I said, I want you to raise yourself the way you raised me. Because I love humanity because of what you taught me. And it seems that you're giving that up to follow this this political warrior into a rabbit hole. And it's so bizarre to watch the woman who led my moral framework supporting a man who was so corrupt. It's heartbreaking.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Oh, it is just devastating. And I'm sorry to hear that. And I really wish that yours was an isolated case, but it's absolutely not. Because in my practice, I hear from people all over the United States who feel that they have lost their parents to QAnon or to whatever you know they're subscribing to at the moment that is so toxic and difficult, and it's really frustrating. I mean, where would we be without technology? It's done so many wonderful things. It makes our communication possible, but it's also easy to hijack technology and use it against people. So that is such a frustration. I'm going to get us back to your story. So you got baptized at 15, and then at some point you went to college. You had mentioned that to me. Was college before or after you rejected the faith?
After. It was after. I had probably quietly rejected the faith around the age of 19.
Mm-hmm.
15 were heavy doubts. 15 to 19 was exploration. 19, I was going, I don't think this is for me, but I was still a drummer in the church, so I kept my job.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also a drummer in a heavy metal band, and I was too young to drink, but I was in the clubs playing drums. So I was showing, Saturday night, I was getting big black X's on my hands.
Right.
And, you know, playing heavy metal until 1:30 in the morning. And then I was rolling into church at 9:15, smelling like cigarettes and beer with, you know, these X's still on my hands, just in the back, like, yay, Holy Ghost, whatever, you know. I was living this weird double life. I just went on this personal journey of sitting down with theology professors and asking them questions. I'd asked my own pastor. I walked into his office one day and said, "Do you have a minute?" And I said, some guys at my job said that they're Pentecostal, and they said that Jesus and God are definitely two separate entities, and Jesus is the Son and God is the Father, and anyone who says that they are one and the same is a heretic. And I said, "But I've heard you say that Jesus is God, so can you help me out?" And you know, those guys at work had flipped through the Bible with me at lunch. We're working at a tire shop, and they'd flipped through the Bible with me and proven to me beyond reasonable doubt with the Bible, that Jesus and God were definitely two different people. There's a verse in Mark 10 where Jesus says, someone calls him good, and he says, why do you call me good? No one is good. No one is good except God alone. Some versions say no one is good except the Father in heaven, clearly separating them. There are verses where he says, God sent me, or my Father sent me to tell you this. If I am me and I decide to go tell my daughter something, I'm not going to say, hey, David told me to tell you, right? I wouldn't call myself my own father. It doesn't make any sense. So I was so clear that Jesus isn't God. Jesus is the Son of God. And then my pastor was mortified. And so he began to flip through the very same book using different scriptures and prove to me beyond all reasonable doubt that Jesus is in fact God. He thought this was a victory, and all this was really was like 20 or 21 year old me going, oh, this Bible is subject to manipulation for whatever you want to believe. And so I started really deconstructing at that point, and I would talk to theology professors, and I would talk to lay Christians and preachers and pastors and everybody that I could as I was writing my book. And I just kept making notes about holes I would find. And I talked to a publisher one day and I was like, I feel like I'm going to write this book forever because there's not an end. And it was Dr. Frank Zindler said to me, books aren't finished, they're abandoned. So you're just going to have to stop and move on with something else. And so I just stopped my book and he published it for me through American Atheist Press. And still to this day, 100% of the proceeds of the paperback go to American Atheist.
And what's the book called again?
Baptized Atheist.
Baptized Atheist.
Now the audio version, I released that version in 2010. The audio version came out in 2012. And I made some revisions. I actually changed my mind on a few things in the audio book. So I explained, this is what I said in the book, and here's what I feel now, and I made a little bit of an update. I overstated like Constantine's role in the canonization and things like that in the paperback, and so I corrected that in the audiobook. It kind of started happening around the same time. I was deconverting for several years. Then I started college as I was finishing my deconversion process, and college really helped with the research aspect and the just understanding what words mean, understanding different bases from the languages, understanding translation errors and confirmation bias and certain fallacies and things like that. Because I was going to school for psychology to be a therapist. And so I realized a lot of what was happening in the church, and I was starting to understand sort of the, you know, narcissistic behaviors of some of the pastors and some of the control issues that they had. And I was like, oh, wait, this is group psychology. Freud talked about this in 1921, where he would say, like, you know, people of my group will make mistakes, but that's due to an external influence over them. But I know they're good because they're in my group. And when your group makes mistakes, it's because you're in the bad group.
Right.
So that's why parishioners of a church can have a pastor that's, you know, convicted of child molestation or infidelity or something horrific, and they'll go, well, we're praying for him. He's a sinner. He apologized. Yeah. But if they hear that an atheist did it, they're like, oh yeah, because he has no morality.
Right.
It's never, you never give a pass to the other guy. So I don't know if I wrote this or if I talked about it on the podcast, but I describe Sigmund Freud's group psychology by saying the idea is that the ego of the group replaces the ego of the individual. So when you see guys in 12 degree weather at Mile High Stadium with Broncos written across their chest, there's one guy who's freezing with a giant R on his chest. It means nothing. He's miserable. His ego means nothing. His warmth means nothing. He's sacrificing so much for the group to be fanatics of a football team. So the group's ego has replaced his own. And the problem is when you go to someone in that group with that mindset and you tell them that their religion doesn't make sense, what you don't realize you're doing is you're asking them to remove a piece of themselves. You're saying your ego is invalid because they are now intertwined.
Yeah.
And so I then made it my mission to help other non-believers talk to believers in a way that wasn't going to be so confrontational, in a way that was more of a rescue mission from love as opposed to a confrontational battle because you're stupid and I'm smart, right?
And so. And this must have led into your podcast development way back when podcasts must have been shiny and new and you were right on it.
You know, funny note about that, I actually had a podcast before the word existed.
What?
I did. I started in 2003. It was a music and comedy podcast. And it was called internet radio that you could listen to later in archives. And there was no word for it. And in 2004, the word podcast eventually was invented.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had a show that you could go listen to before RSS feeds were invented. So that's how long I've been in the game, Janice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So then 2010, I was like, hey, I want to use that stuff I did for comedy and music. And actually, instead of, you know, I'd had a blog called dogmadebate.com, and that's where people would argue about stuff. And I was trying to keep it cordial and I would moderate.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get to everybody. It got really popular. And I was like, what if I just invited them on to have a conversation? So the first thing I did was I would record myself calling into religious internet radio shows.
Oh.
I would record it and then I would play it. And then I thought, that's kind of a copyright issue, right? It's their show and I'm recording it and playing it. So I shouldn't do that. So I would just invite them onto my show and record it. And we started with Xbox headsets, you know?
Yeah.
And a giant Macintosh computer. And that was the beginning of Dogma Debate, which eventually became the David C. Smalley podcast. And, you know, I did it from 2010 to 2013. And at that moment, it became my full-time job. And I haven't looked back. I mean, I've been doing this full-time since 2013. I was able to quit my IT job. So,
oh my gosh. And so the comedy, has the comedy been something that you have done all along as the same time you were doing the podcast?
So that's such a good question. I actually did comedy in 2001, one time. I was 21 years old. I went up, I had one joke. And
was it about fish?
No, it wasn't about fish. That's an inside joke that they're not going to get. But
that's right.
I did one joke and I thought that was just going to get me started and then I was going to crush it for the next 10 minutes.
Right.
And I did my one joke that I'd written and I thought I was just going to like vibe with the crowd. That's not the way comedy works. You've got to write. You've got to perfect your material. I did my one joke and panicked. I got a laugh. Then I panicked and went, yeah, that's about it for me. And they were like, what? You've been up here 45 seconds. And then so they laughed a little bit and I thought, oh yeah, I can't go yet. So I did a little crowd work. I talked to some ladies up front and I made fun of a guy and they laughed. And then I ran out of steam. I did about 90 seconds and went, okay, that's my time. And I didn't do comedy again until I was 35 years old.
Oh.
36 actually, at the Reason Rally. So I'd always wanted to do it. I wanted to do it since I was a little kid. And that was my one time trying it. And I was like, never again. That was horrific. And then when I was 36, I got invited to host a comedy show at the Reason Rally. And so I was like, I think I can write this time. And I'd had a great set in front of 500 people. It was sold out.
Cool.
And that's when the bug bit me. So I'm a little bit of a late start when it comes to the stand-up. But it's important to note that all that time in between, I was either in bands, a lead singer in a band, or giving talks about skepticism or atheism or talking with believers. And I was doing so, and I always try to make it fun and lighthearted. So I was writing jokes, and I was on stage doing 45 minutes at a time. So when I actually went to the first comedy club in Los Angeles, which was the Comedy Store, where I actually started, I was way more comfortable on stage than a new comedian should be.
Yes.
So I kind of had a head start, you know,
being
on stage for
You're 15, so good with years. People. I think you have an ability to put people at ease and make them feel comfortable. I know you do that in your podcast, so it makes sense that with your comedy, people also just feel like they can relate to you.
Well, thank you so much for that. It's very sweet. Yeah, it's weird on stage because I try to do that, but sometimes the angle of the bit is like anger or something vicious, and it's weird because they're like, we look mean if we look at your picture, But you don't come across that way on stage, so I can't be the mean guy to be funny. It's just not believable. So I get what you're saying. I try to have a good time up there, and sometimes I have to be a jerk, but mostly it's fun, you know. So
the TikTok stuff you're doing with your daughter, oh my god, I literally laugh out loud every time. It's just hysterically funny. I love it.
That warms my heart. I appreciate that. We've actually started a whole podcast called Daughter Issues that we do about that. It's about the generation gaps. What, for people who haven't seen it, I started ambushing my daughter as though we were in the 90s and there were problems I needed help with. And I would just come around the corner and be like, Windows 98 crashed. Have you seen my floppy? And she's 18. She has no clue what any of those words mean. And she would just stare at me and be like, what? And I would be in a panic. I'm like, Windows 98 crashed. I got to reboot in safe mode. Have you seen my floppy? And she's like, floppy what? And I just cut the video off right there, but what you're not listening to is me dying laughing. So I started posting things like that and exploring like the generation gap. And I noticed people, there were young people, there were Gen Zers who were sending it to their parents going, what's he talking about? This is crazy. And then older Gen X or boomers were sending the videos to their kids going, this guy messes with his daughter the way I mess with you. So everyone's sharing it with each other and the video started to take off. And so I was
you're bringing people together.
There's something here, yeah. And I got to tell you, my show that I do gets really heavy sometimes, you know, so it's so nice to be able to sit down with my daughter, who I'm very close with, and have a fun conversation. We just did one right before I came on with you about toys, and I got to tell her about, you know, Pogs and Stretch Armstrong and He-Man, and it's so nice to just have a fun conversation like that that's not so deep and heavy about religious belief and you're going to hell and you have no morality and women can't have abortions, and it's so nice to have a peaceful fun conversation like that. So
I do I started on TikTok just doing kind of an alter ego or a different persona for myself. And I'm talking typically about religious type stuff, but I'm doing it just from a more comedic angle. And it's a really nice release because, as you say, if your whole life is about religious trauma, so I'm doing conferences and I'm doing the podcast and I see clients one-on-one, that's a lot of religious trauma to have day in, day out. And then, I'm going to take a break and watch the news because the news is so lighthearted.
Right. I'm so glad you're doing that. I don't think I could do it. And people write me and say, I could never do what you do. Mm-hmm. My shows will go 2, maybe 3 hours. I can't imagine taking on someone else's religious trauma as a full-time job, 7-8 hours in a day. Mm-hmm. There's no way. I can tell you, now mine are more contentious and argumentative, and yours are more supportive because you're talking with someone who's been victimized, right? Mm-hmm. But in my situation, I feel like I'm trying to save someone who doesn't know they're a victim. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to pull them out of the burning building and they're going, the arson is a good guy. Leave me alone.
Right.
And I'm like,
right.
Come, like it's okay. And they're terrified to be outside and it's crazy. And when I'm done in those hour and a half, 3 hours, I am exhausted. Like you're like, okay, we'll do the show from 3 to 6 and then we'll have dinner. I'm like, I'm going to bed.
Yeah.
Or I'm just going to go sit and smoke a cigar or just lay on the couch. And like, I want to watch SpongeBob. I don't want to do anything that requires any sort of thought. And it takes so much out of me. So I couldn't imagine doing it as long as you do for having clients that off. There's no way. Dennis,
I think the trickiest part for me is when I am contacted by people who are still religious, like they still very much love Jesus and love God, but they're starting to recognize that there are parts of the Bible that don't quite work for them anymore. Or they recognize that their old church, you know, was really bad and traumatized them, or however they want to say it. But now they're noticing some things in their new church that's also, and I'm an atheist, and I'm typically working with people who have divorced religion. Religion is in their rearview mirror, but they're trying to unpack and process everything that happened. So it is tricky when people who are still religious contact me and want help. And sometimes I refer them on to other people, and, you know, other times I'll tell them, here's my stance, and you can look at my, you can go to my website and learn about me and what I believe. Do you feel comfortable working with me? And so if they do, then we're off to the races, but that one's a tricky one to navigate.
Yeah, I bet. Because I wouldn't want to let them go. I would want to talk to them and hopefully help them out of their situation. But that's a decision they have to make. And I know as a therapist, that's what you do. It's more so about listening and questioning and having them come to their own solutions. It's not so much of a debate, right? But you're going to, if you push back, you're just going to strengthen their defenses, right? So yeah, being an open ear is so important in that situation. And I
get frustrated sometimes with other counselors who are still religious, like Christian counselors. I got my air quotes going on. Because I feel like a big part of being a therapist is helping clients to radically accept reality. Reality, not fantasy. You know, not what the hell they wish it would be. And so I feel like people who are still really entrenched in religion are very much engaged in magical thinking,
I have to say, I recently signed up for therapy. And when I did, I was going through this company and they ask you all those questions. Would you want someone non-religious? Do you want someone this and this and this? And this wasn't about the person. It was more so what type of therapy you want. Do you want non-religious secular therapy? And they let me choose all of that. So I did. Yes. And day one, I meet with a therapist. She's amazing. I mean, so good, so healthy. Good. It was so good for me. And we talked through all these things. She's fantastic. She never mentions anything about faith. She did exactly what, you know, all the boxes checked. And I was like, oh man, this is going to be great. This is going to be my long-term therapist. I'm going to love her. And the second time we met, she's wearing a huge cross necklace. And she didn't mention anything about it. She didn't say anything, but it did kind of make me have that same thought. Like, you know, I know she can obviously turn it off, I guess, because she did the first time, but it, I don't know. It's not that she can't be who she wants to be. That's fine. But it did kind of make me wonder if, she really gets everything that I'm talking about. You know what I mean? So,
Yeah, that put her wearing that religious iconography put a block between you rather than a bridge.
Right. But I don't, I'm never going to say anything about it. I would just, you know, and she's great, but now I feel like it's not going to be as good as it could be if my therapist were actually.
David, you don't have to stay with her. You're allowed to find someone that you feel like will listen completely. I mean, she does, I'm very glad that you're endorsing therapy. People need therapy. It can be very helpful. I also have a therapist that I meet with on Zoom, because there's no way I could listen to everyone else's trauma all day and not, you know, offload some of it. I don't want to get crushed under it.
Yeah. I mean, look, everybody does therapy. They just, most of them do it wrong. they talk to their friends over beer and they just go in and rant, and their buddy isn't trained. So he's just giving them bad advice or not asking the right questions or supporting very destructive behavior with a nod and a toast. Right. And so we all do it. There's no shame in it. You're just doing it wrong if you're only doing it with your fishing buddy or at a bar. You should talk to someone who's trained in asking the right questions. And most of the stuff, and this is the I guess the green, or the, what am I trying to say? Like the aha moment for me, almost everything she's ever said to me, I already knew.
Right.
It's more so about hearing the things that you needed to hear. and getting permission to feel the things that you always wanted to feel but felt guilty for some other reason.
Yes. So
for feeling guilty for setting up a boundary or for like someone will call you selfish for having a boundary or they want to insult you to get their way. And you learn that those are manipulation tactics that people do for people that want to help and want to love and want to be there. And so getting permission to have self-care is super important. And your buddy's not going to do that over Bud Lights. So, you know, finding a therapist and doing it, someone who's certified, you know, to ask the right questions is super important.
Excellent. I wonder in our last few minutes, do you have any recommendations for other people who are on this journey of religious deconversion?
Oh my gosh. Well, selfishly, you're always welcome to come on my podcast and talk about it.
Nice.
I've had several people who say, you know, I'm kind of on the fence and I want to know what you think about some stuff. And I go, let's do it. And they come on and within weeks, they're no longer a believer. And that's fine. And there have been people come on and ask me questions about the Bible and they leave and go, I think my faith is stronger. And I go, hey, at least you're informed about what it is you believe. Let's keep talking. So if there are people out there that are on the fence, or if people are saying, you know, I want to talk about why I believe, but I want to talk about why the Bible's not necessary for that belief or why this isn't, you're welcome to come on. And if anyone does want to come on the show, you go to davidcsmalley.com, click be a guest, and there's a very brief form you fill out, and then I'll put you on the schedule and I would love to talk to you.
Nice.
Other than that, I would say, absorbing as much content as you can. Listen to Christian content and then listen to non-Christian content or even anti-Christian content. Listen to what the atheists are saying and get to know their points. Podcasts like mine, if you're not listening to me, listen to Seth Andrews. Listen to, there are call-in shows that you could watch on YouTube. And you know, there are going to be people that upset you, you know. What's the saying? The truth shall set you free, but first it'll piss you off.
That's right.
there are going to be things that'll be uncomfortable, and that's okay. Someone corrected me on something the other day, and it didn't feel good at first, and I had to go, you know what? They're right. And I had to tell them, I apologize. You're correct. I said this wrong thing. I didn't mean to say that, and it didn't feel good, but I'm so glad I can stand here today and say I did the right thing and I corrected myself.
Yeah.
So it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to be wrong. More than anything, and I would say to the people who are already the non-believers, please don't look at this as them being your enemy. Look at this from a perspective of they are victims of bad ideas. The best thing you can do for them is not give them a bunch of facts or tell them that they believe in Santa Claus for grownups or insult them. You're not going to win any battles by belittling people.
Right.
Honestly, the best thing you can do that I've learned over my 12 years of doing this is helping them understand that there is a safe place to land. Because so many people that are religious, they're not just religious because they have a belief. It's about so much more than that. It's about a community that they have. It's about their friends and family. And, you know, their cousin goes to that church and the guy that helped them build the fence and they go to the barbecues and they work with three guys that also go to that church. It's about promotions and everything is, they probably met their wife there or got married to their husband at that church. The pastor counsels them. Like, you're not just going to be like, we don't even know Jesus existed. And they're going to go, okay, then I'm going to give up my entire life.
Right.
And then what you do is you think they should give up their faith because of that. So you start getting frustrated at your own inability to instantly deconvert someone. And that anger you're having, you take it out on them and project all of those feelings onto that person. And then you just push them away and end up in a giant fight. So my, if you instead look at it as I'm going to start from a position of love, and I realize that this believer, if they're willing to have that conversation, they've already had doubts of their own, and that's fine. We don't want to make them feel guilty. We don't want to have an aha moment. We don't want to, you know, spike the ball and do a touchdown dance. Understand that that person is on a playground and they're holding one of those bars and their feet are dangling.
Oh, yeah.
And they have no idea how far away the ground is.
Yeah.
You're standing on the ground behind them and you know it's a one-inch drop.
Right.
But they don't know that. They don't know that they'll have a community that will love them and support them. Mm-hmm. They don't know that reality is so much more comforting than mystic beliefs. Mm-hmm. They just don't know. So are you going to berate that person and call them an idiot and say, just let go, dummy? You're not going to do anybody any favors. The thing for you to do is to walk in front of them and say, I'm standing on the ground and I'm fine. You're okay. And I'm going to be here for you. I promise you're not going to get hurt. And show them things like humanism. Instead of being anti-religious, try being pro-humanist. And,
nice.
And be a voice for reason to tell people that loving humanity, it's okay to feel connected to something bigger than yourself. That's called all of humanity. And it's perfectly fine to feel love for people you don't know. And we don't need a God in order to have that feeling. So sharing those types of thoughts and feelings with people can help them understand there is a way to be moral. There is a way to be good. There is a way to show love without religion. And there is a way to have community without religion. And once they know that's a possibility, now it's not so scary to perhaps entertain, maybe I might be wrong about some stuff.
Wow. Beautifully, beautifully said. Very encouraging. I think what you're saying is right on the money. And earlier on, you mentioned recoveringfromreligion.org. I know they're a wonderful community kind of organization for people who are questioning their faith or who have left the faith and are looking for support. Yeah. Journeyfree.org with Dr. Marlene Winnell, another great place that people can go. And certainly I encourage people to keep listening to your podcast, and hopefully they'll keep listening to my podcast as well. Thank you so much for joining me today, David. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to the Conference on Religion YouTube channel so you never miss an episode of the Divorcing Religion podcast. And if you feel like it, I'd love for you to support me on Patreon. Thanks, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.